it's academics and you're trying to figure out a major, and you just can't kind of put it all together. Or maybe it's, you know, relationships, or maybe it's your work life, or maybe there's, you know, financial decisions that you seem to keep on making that keep getting you into trouble. You know, and maybe it's some deeper addictions or things like this. Maybe you're struggling to lower or quit alcohol or cigarettes or some kind of drug or some kind of addiction like that. And it's like there's a part of your mind that knows, okay, there should be a change. A positive change would be better, and you would live a happier life. You can intellectually, you got that piece. You know, you don't really have to have someone to tell you that's bad for you, and you'd live happier if you did X, Y, or Z. And yet, it can be so hard to somehow understand a way out of whatever that particular habit is. I'm reminded when I sit down sometimes with married couples and, you know, and things aren't going really well. And you'll have like the, you know, bright, well-intentioned, you know, both sides of the relationship, you know, good hearts, they care for each other, they really love each other. And yet, when things get intractable, when the conversation gets heated, and you can kind of watch it go in stages, and it's almost like they just can't help themselves. It's like they don't want to do it, and yet they can't seem to almost see what it is they're actually doing. They can't somehow see themselves. And I think there's something in that that is perhaps not just the struggle of our relationships or the struggle of how we live our lives, the struggle of faith itself. But I think there's something in that that may be humanity's great downfall, that we have a hard time seeing what it is that we're doing. There's a story in Genesis. It's the creation story of humanity. Sometimes it's also called the fall, because in the story, it's both sort of the birth of humanity as well as the fall. So it's sort of the birth of humanity has this tragic element in it. And it's the apple story. You all are somewhat familiar. You know the apple part, right? Okay, you've seen the movie, all right, the cartoon. So let me read this part. It's right, okay. The fruit has been eaten. And their eyes opened, and then they realized they were naked, and they were ashamed. So they sewed fig leaves together and made coverings of themselves. Then the man and the woman heard the sound of God as he was walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and they hid from God among the trees of the garden. God called out to the man, "Where are you?" And he answered, "I heard you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid." And God said, "Who told you that you were naked?" Now, there's a few interesting things about this story. I think the first one is that the people were already naked. But in the story, in the fall, they became aware of being naked and were ashamed. And so you have this sort of birth story of humanity becoming conscious, and then you have this other part of the story in which the first place they put that newfound consciousness and awareness, it goes straight to their nakedness, and they become ashamed and start covering up and hide from God. Now, I do think this is one of those stories where God's actually mad in the story, and I think sometimes this gets interpreted that God is mad at people. Right, that's the wrathful God is mad at people. But I think it's a story of God being mad, but not at the people. I mean, here he is, he creates folks in his own image, God's image, and the first thing they do is start covering it up. It's a little bit like my kid. So let me just say, though, and I'm going to reread it, that I do think there's anger here. But it's not at the people. I think it's anger, it's what's happened to them and what is happening to them. And I think what happens to us? The fruit's eaten. Their eyes opened and they realized they were naked and were ashamed, so they sewed fig leaves together and made coverings for themselves. Then the man and the woman heard the sound of God as he was walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and they hid from God among the trees of the garden. But God called the man, "Where are you?" And he answered, "I heard you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid." And God said, in angry voice, "Who told you that you were naked? Who told you that you were naked and should be ashamed? Who told you that you were naked and should be afraid and to cover yourselves up? Who keeps telling you that you're naked and should be ashamed?" As long as you're listening to that voice, that is the wrong voice to listen to. But who is it that tells you that you're naked and should be ashamed? Who tells you to cover up? Who tells you that you're not good enough that you should cover up? Who tells you maybe you don't have the right job or the right education and that you should cover that up? Who tells you maybe that you're, if you're gay or lesbian, that that's not good, that's not dignity of the humanity of your sexuality is in question, and that you got to cover that up? Who tells you that maybe you shouldn't be hanging out with certain people because that would look bad, and you cover it up? Who tells you that you're naked and should be ashamed of who you are? Who tells you that you don't conform to some notion of beauty, so you should cover yourself up? You should be ashamed of yourself. Who tells you maybe you don't talk right? Who tells you that maybe you don't think all the right ideas or you don't do all the cool things, the respectable things? Who tells you? Who tells you that? You should be ashamed and cover yourselves up, because that's the wrong voice to listen to. You wonder where that voice is coming from. Are you covering up to hide from something? To impress someone? Maybe to fool someone? Or maybe we do it just to fool ourselves, because we're maybe afraid of what we look like in the mirror, naked. But the truth is, all of us are already naked. We just have some clothes on. That's all. We cover up because, of course, we think it'll protect us, and it can. All of us have been beaten down at some point in life. We've faced hurts, and it's certainly natural to cover ourselves up to protect us. But remember that covering up is reactive. It's reacting against something outside of us. It's reacting to that voice that says we should be ashamed, we should be scared, or at least we should be uncomfortable with who we are. So covering up, it does protect us, but at a price. It protects us, but we also end up sacrificing something about ourselves. See, what we don't accept about reality doesn't disappear. We know that, I think, intellectually. What we don't accept about ourselves doesn't disappear. In fact, generally it gets projected outward. It makes us react to things rather than live out of our own stories. I think about some of the family values preachers, and there was one by the name of Ted Haggard. He was the president of the National Evangelical Association. Very important person in that. And he preached a very black and white kind of gospel about, you know, the right place of men and women and families. And at the same time, his personal life, a shambles. Complete shambles. He was having a relationship with another man. I think there was even drugs involved. And he was exposed. All of a sudden, he was naked. And he had to deal with that. And he left his church and ended up on Oprah because, of course. But it was interesting in the interview with Oprah and sort of recounting this experience he'd gone through, which had certainly, where he had basically not only been covering up himself, but basically teaching others to cover up themselves as well. And all of a sudden having this experience that basically exposed him as naked a soul as you can get, obviously not by his free will, but that's where he went. But in that experience, it changed him. He became naked and it changed him. And when she commented, Oprah asked him something about sexuality at this point, and he just said, you know, it's complicated. It's a complicated thing. And we all need to kind of do that journey. And he's like, whatever you think right or wrong is, it's complicated. And we got to respect that. That's a pretty sharp 180 kind of change. You know, they say one of the deepest fears we have is the fear of being found out. You know, the fear of being exposed for exactly who it is that you are. Being naked, really. Of course, I think there's another fear that's maybe even deeper. Maybe comes from a different part of our experience, and that is the fear of never being found out. Of never being exposed. Of never being able to share who you are. Really. And honestly, with one another. I once read a thing by a sociologist who described middle-class American culture. The middle-class American culture means everything is fine. You know what I mean by that? We look fine. People ask you, you say you're fine. Having a good day, you may even see things are great. But we also know that everything is not always fine. In fact, in our lives, at any given moment, there's something in your life that is not just fine. But we clothe ourselves in this story, this middle-class American clothing, that everything is fine. We cover it up because, well, we're listening to a voice that says to be otherwise is something we should be ashamed of or afraid of. Voice that says we should be ashamed of what's underneath. So we pretend everything's fine. That's our popular culture. In fact, if you listen to what we think of as pop culture music, pop music, the lyrics, the top 40 songs that make it really big for like 3 weeks and then you never hear from that artist again, that thing, it's almost always lyrics that are about everything being fine and happy. It's, you know, I love you, I love you, I love you, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's kind of a snappy little beat or something, right? And it rises and everyone's like singing that and then it crashes because nobody cares. That's pop culture. And then there's a different kind of music that comes after that and can be defined as either punk or grunge or country music does this, other forms of music do this. But it's basically the theme of that kind of music is, no, it's not fine. In fact, it's terrible. It's horrible. And that music's very popular, too. There's a lot of energy that's around that music. And it's not because people want to think about how horrible and terrible it is, but it's the fact that at least it's honest. Because we know that it's not fine all the time. That doesn't actually resonate with the truth of what life is like. And so there's a lot of energy around that kind of music. But then there's actually a third kind. And it's sort of like the first, and kind of like the second. And I think of a band maybe like U2 and their song Beautiful Day. And the chorus is It's a Beautiful Day, which is kind of a pop type chorus. But if you listen to the actual lyrics, it's just a string of the ambiguity of the world. From everything like dead whales and China and, you know, it doesn't, any rhyme, it's just the ambiguity of it all. And so there's a kind of experience that goes through the darkness and comes out on the other side with a certain space of joy, a certain space of grace that can say, yes, it is a beautiful day, and it's not naive, it's not shallow, it's not pop, but it's a deeper kind of experience, a deeper kind of joy. I think about, if you've ever seen the Dalai Lama, who's Buddhist, and the Reverend Desmond Bishop Tutu, who was in South Africa in prison for quite some time. And they're actually good friends. And when they meet, they basically start giggling and tickling each other. Now, these are two individuals that have gone through traumatic experiences that make anything that I know I've been in my life pale in comparison. You know, after 30 years in prison, you know, then I can, you know, judge whatever they've gone through. But until then, and yet they've come out on the other side in this space of grace and joy and hope that's not shallow, it's not pretend, it's not just another covering up, but it's a naked joy. It's a naked hope. It's real because they've already been stripped down. And I think about, like, if you've ever been in love and in a relationship and that you're really into and then it broke up, I'm sure I'm the only one who's done that. And especially if you're like the one who's sort of the clueless one about where this was heading, you know, the one who's a little more in shock than the other. I mean, it really doesn't matter. It could be either, but, you know, you have heartbreak, a heartbreaking experience. And it could be anything, wouldn't have to be a love relationship, but you have a heartbreaking experience with a relationship, and it's heartbreaking, and it's over, and it hurts. And then you have a story inside your mind about how you should relate to that person. And the story inside your mind says, well, you know, the good thing to do would be to be like forgiving and be mature in this relationship and be generous and, you know, let them know that things are okay. And, you know, there's that story that we think, oh, we should live out. And yet at the same time, we know deep down that that's not the real story. That's just a cover up. That's like a pretend, I'm pretending to be spiritual, right? I'm putting on just some religious looking clothing that says, I'm the forgiving one. Watch me be forgiving. And yet deep down inside, we know it's not true. It's like pop music. It's not real. Sometimes what you need to do is get down and actually be angry. Actually get down to where something is true. Taking off whatever clothing you think you're supposed to be putting on for whatever story you think you're supposed to be living. And stop hiding. There's a great movie called The Wedding Singer with Adam Sandler in it, and there's a scene in that movie. He plays music in the movie, and it's this great song he actually sings, because half of it is written when he's engaged and in love to the love of his life and they're about to get married, and then the other half of the song is after she dumped him and broke up with him. And he's just miserable. And so he sings this song, and like one verse says, oh, I love everything and life is beautiful. And then the next crashes right in the next verse, which is, I hate women. I hate them. I hate life. Everyone should die. And sometimes, though, the thing is, there's an honesty there. There's a reality there that we understand. Because sometimes you do need to be angry. Sometimes you do need to vent. So there is bitterness that needs to be uncovered, because you do need to get to a place that's honest, a place that you know is actually true. And the thing is, as you uncover yourself, and here comes the universalist message, as you uncover yourself, as uncomfortable as that is, there is grace. There is grace there that allows your story to change. So it's no longer about the story you think you have to be living, but it allows your story to change. And then when you see that person, because you've become naked and allowed that story to change, you can honestly say, you know, I realize that we're not a part of each other's life anymore. And I miss you. And I really wish you the best. And it's not a cover-up. It's just now become something honest, something real. It's not you're doing it because you have to. It's because your story has changed. And that's the beauty and the power of grace, is that it's not only like an ends, but it's a means to an end. It's a means to greater acceptance and authenticity, in which authenticity is really just that ability to uncover who it is you really are. I worked in a hospice for a little while, and I was very new to ministry. I was still in school. And in a hospice, of course, it's a place where people go to die, and so everyone dies. And we had some in-house rooms for people that were closer to the time of death. And I remember it was, my first or second day, and there was a guy named Mike in one of the rooms, and Mike was dying of AIDS. And this was the mid-90s, so I knew a little, but not a lot, about AIDS, and so it was still had enough of a stigma that it bothered me, freaked me out a little bit, made me a little bit scared. And then, of course, adding on to that, the whole idea that I was going to try and comfort someone that was dying. So, I thought, oh, what am I going to do? I'm scared. And so I thought, well, what I'm going to do then is, like, figure out what I need to do to be prepared and adequate to the task of being with this dying person, which, of course, was impossible, because how could you be adequate to that task? And so after a couple days of, I'm ashamed to admit, walking right by that door and not entering into that space because I was inadequate to the task, somehow I got enough courage and faith to enter into that door and enter into that situation in which I was still very inadequate for the task. And I sat down and talked with him. He was semi-conscious most of the time. And at the end, he asked, will we pray with me? Yeah, I thought, okay, sure. And I didn't really have a lot of experience with this, and I did this long-winded, just terrible prayer. It was garbage, really. I mean, I think I threw in some old English. I mean, and I got to the end, and I think I apologized to him for how bad the prayer was. And at that moment, he grabbed, I could feel some strength in his hand, and he became lucid for a moment and kind of sat up. He said, no, that was great. God bless you. And, that's a word that gets bandied about a bunch and really doesn't mean much most of the time. But in that moment, in that space of authenticity, in that space in which there is the druggie who is dying and abandoned by his family and friends because of what he'd done in his previous life, sitting there with a totally inexperienced, inadequate, incompetent chaplain, two naked people, we were blessed, and it was a space of grace in which that meaningless phrase, God bless you, actually meant something. I think that is actually the amazing thing about grace, is that it's about that other voice. Not the voice that tells you got to cover up, the voice that tells you there's something wrong in here, or that there's something so wrong in here that you just better cover it up. But rather it says you're good enough, not because you're good or you're perfect. You're good, warts and all. In fact, it says that you don't need to even change. And what's interesting is that when you can accept that you're actually accepted, you are actually in the space where transformation happens. And so the paradox is, and this is weird, But I've seen it happen again and again. The paradox is that the very place, the very space where you begin to change is the very same place where you don't feel the need to change. Where you begin to change is where you don't need to change. And it's an interesting thing because you can't really move forward in life unless you're embracing life. And when I embrace life, I'm actually embracing my imperfections. I'm embracing my own ugliness, which is a hard thing to do. That's the challenge of universalism. It's easy to have a premise that says God loves you or God loves everyone, but to really open yourself up to accept even that ugliness and accept it. But at that point of accepting that I'm accepted, accepting that, you know what, you don't need to actually change, that's the point at which I can move forward in my life. It's that honesty that happens when we get naked. Now, I always think about, you know, when I see relationships in trouble and they just can't seem to sort of see what they're doing to one another. And the reality is why that seems that way is because they can't. They're too covered up. They've gotten too good at covering up and creating whatever story they think they're supposed to be creating. It doesn't have to be love relationships, any kind of relationships. Oftentimes what I see is we confuse authenticity and honesty with being opinionated. You ever seen that one? Because opinionated, really, that's just being reactive. That's just being reactive. It's sort of the difference between blaming someone because they hurt you and why they did this to you and being able to actually honestly share how it is that you're hurting in your life. Hopefully you can track the difference there. And so, in the end, grace is a key to a number of things. It's certainly a key to spirituality. I mean, struggling with doubt is tough. I mean, most of us rather not do it. We struggle with it in different ways. Sometimes we struggle by intellectualizing our doubts, doubt about ourselves, doubt about our future, doubt about our own sort of spiritual place in the world. We can intellectualize it as if life is just some giant physics problem, and if we can get the right equation in place, then, boom, things will be beautiful. If you figure out that equation, let me know. But so far, I haven't found it. Doubting life, even doubting God, doubting whatever faith perspective that you hold on to deeply. I mean, we got to get to a place where we can do that, as uncomfortable as that may be. I always like to say, from a universalist perspective, you know, if God's love is actually real, then anything that draws us towards reality draws us closer to that love and that grace, even if that makes you an atheist. That's a little postmodern for you. Yes, the atheist is closer to God than the person with the big religious clothing on, because someone's more naked than the other. But, or vice versa, whatever it is. But it's a key to spirituality, is getting to that place of honesty, because it's not that I'm lying to you, but it's that I'm lying to myself generally. It's a key to building community, because without sort of spaces of authenticity, then we really can't share any of this. Then we're really just sort of pretending, aren't we? And that can get us by in the world a little bit, but it cuts us off from so much. I always think the church should be that place where if no other place in society allows us, that it should be that place where we can actually practice what it means to be human. And therefore be human and be authentic and be real. A place that allows us to sort of open our hearts to that experience, as vulnerable as it may be. But those experiences are so rare, which is why they're so precious. And regardless of whatever cultural shifts are going on out there in the world, I think the church can always remain a vital place if it creates those opportunities and those spaces of grace and authenticity in people's lives. Certainly living into this progressive covenant that we call Unitarian Universalism requires we serve a vision of that kind of authenticity where we are always creating for all different kinds of groups of people that space for grace. That space where we can be the countervailing voice. In a world in which so much of the voices that we hear are telling us to cover up, whether because it's for good marketing or profit, or whether it's just long-standing cultural traditions, or because we think we got to be fine because we're middle-class Americans, whatever it is, boy, the church has a powerful mission to be that countervailing voice, to be that other voice, that voice of grace, that voice that allows us to strip ourselves of that story and do something and be something real. Accepting who we are and accepting the world as it is as well. Because accepting the world as it is not about being at war with it, not about being alienated from it, but being able to engage it with compassion and hearts open to the diversity of people out there. And finally, maybe authenticity is such a gift of grace because the covering we put on to hide ourselves and protect ourselves from reality also walls us off from that very same reality we call life. Which is to say, it walls us off from the deeper experiences of our humanity and what it means to be human. And after all, as James Luther Adams reminds us, perhaps that's the high purpose of the church, is to practice what it means to be human. And so it is that I think this kind of grace and in my experience of this kind of authenticity is what allows us, wherever it is we stand, to begin a journey into ever deeper, ever more profound, and ever more transformative experiences of life, its meaning, and grace. Let me end with this poem. It's about grace. It's about universalism, the God who loves us all. And it goes like this. I am the blossom pressed in a book and found again 200 years later. I am the maker, the lover, and the keeper. When the young girl who starves sits down to a table, she will sit beside me. I am food on the prisoner's plate. I am water rushing to the wellhead, filling the pitcher until it spills. I am the patient gardener of the dry and weedy garden. I'm the stone step, the latch, and the working hinge. I'm the heart contracted by joy, the longest hair white before the rest. I am the basket of fruit presented to the widow. I am the musk rose opening unattended, the fern on the boggy summit. I am the one whose love overcomes you. Already with you when you think to call my name. And I'll take a moment, if you're into prayer, you pray with me. If not, take a moment for yourself. Gracious God, I just want to give thanks for this opportunity personally to be with these people. And this is a prayer for them that they find ways to just deepen their experiences of grace and create spaces like that for one another, and for the spiritual hunger that is out there in their community, that they can really discover from the authenticity and honesty of their own gifts, their own passions, and even with their own weaknesses, that kind of calling and perspective that is going to allow them to be such a blessing in this space, in this time, in this town of Rockford. And with that, we'll say thank you and amen.